Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, Eastern family, and thanks for listening and being part of the radio voice of Eastern Airlines today. Thank you for joining us for episode 17 from the Eastern Files. The program is dedicated to memories and stories of former Eastern people and news from the New Eastern. As we hear from the New Eastern, we'll pass it on to you. These broadcasts are usually only about 1/2 hour in duration and broadcast at this time slot, which is 3 p.m. Eastern Time. We may even throw in a music selection or two. The program is not only talk radio format, and we will not take calls during the show. It's reserved only for Eastern stories, histories, news, the customer. We will continue to broadcast our normal talk radio call-in live show as we do on every Monday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. We hope you like these stories as they are presented from the Eastern Files. And now, from the Eastern File, we'll pull an Eastern commercial.
It's Sunday in Mexico. The sun floods an arena. The historic duel is on. The sun spotlights a diver at Acapulco. Referees a children's game at the pyramids of Teotihuacan. The sun warms a beautiful mermaid in Puerto Rico and covers the vacation paradise of Miami. Every year, more people choose this one to the sun because Eastern service is as warm as the destination.
Fly Eastern, number one to the sun.
Our story today is from the 1987 magazine, printed by the Retired Eastern Pilots Association and known as Repartee Magazine. This story deals with a favorite captain among many flying back in the day, and the title is There'll Never Be Another Slim. He was larger than life. He was funny as hell. Just about every time he opened his mouth, it was a wisecrack that rolled out most of all of us down the aisle. Sometimes it seemed he was almost laughing at humor itself. If you weren't careful when you spoke, he might paint you right into the corner with a jewel of wisdom cloaked in his subtle humor. All you had to do to get him to smile was to say, "Hi, Slim." He loved us all the men of his profession. No man worked harder or with more sincere desire to help fellow pilots than did our W.T. Babbitt, affectionately known as Slim. He was tall, slender, fun-loving, smart as a whip, lovable, kind, and intellectual in his own way. Intellectually, Slim could get it all said with four-letter words. He never tried to impress anyone with big words. In fact, I think he disdained them. His attitude was that people who used big words probably didn't know what they meant anyway. Slim was the opposite of William Buckley of firing line fame, who has a vocabulary that can make English sound like a foreign language. Some people say you have to have to be a Rhodes Scholar to understand what he's talking about. Not so with Slim. When he spoke, you got the message. He could disarm his worst enemy with his quick wit. A good example of this is a story by Jerry Wood. Both of them were in a conference during the 1948 National Pilots Strike. With National Airlines President G.T. Baker, George T. Baker, his attorney, Bobby Rohan, and others, Slim and Jerry made their statements rather forcefully. Baker blew up. He pointed his finger at them, saying, "You two bastards have never run an airline, and you wouldn't be able to if you had the chance." Jerry relates he was rendered momentarily speechless, but not Slim. Slim said to Mr. Baker politely, "Mr. Baker, maybe we can't run an airline, but we can sure as hell keep one from running." This story underscores another quality Slim had. He could think fast as lightning on his feet. I believe it is a talent you have to be born with. Slim simply was a wizard, fast thinker, under pressure, and was never without an answer. You couldn't box him into a corner if you tried pressure. You'd be likely to wind up with the dunce cap sitting on your head. Jerry relates only one time he saw Slim speechless. He had carried a sack of mangoes from Miami to Washington to give to the CAB, Chairman Joe O'Donnell. When O'Donnell opened the sack, he said, "I'll be damned," as he lifted out an Idaho potato. Slim had unknowingly switched brown bags with one Margaret had brought from Publix Market. Of course, the mistake was corrected and later, but Slim had been caught off guard for once. I have always agreed with the old cliche, "Show me a man who has no enemies, and I'll show you a man who has accomplished nothing." Slim was a man of action and accomplishments. For so many years, he probably stepped on a toe or two, but his goodness was so genuine that for every enemy he may have made, he made hundreds of friends. He was certainly the Will Rogers of the airline pilots. He never met a pilot he didn't like, and friendship for Slim transcended all company lines. Pilots from all the airlines who knew him and were appreciation for this warm, funny, quick-witted, colorful kind of guy. I confess to you, I write this story of Slim with a heavy heart because I really loved and admired the guy. So many times in my life, I've made the observation that God did a beautiful job when he conceived the life and loves for a man on this earth, which certainly is a Garden of Eden when you compare it to the lifeless surface of the moon, the dead planet Mars, the fierce, fiery furnace of Mercury, or the tightly frozen, lifeless atmospheres of Jupiter, Uranus, and Neptune. But it seems to me he made a mistake the way he ends the story. All the beauty of religion and the comforting words of the Bible, to the contrary notwithstanding, we grow old and die. I accept this because I have to, but not without the judgment it should get poor marks as the last act in this beautiful play we all have parts in. I never talk about religion with Slim, but I'm sure he would have come up with some sage observations. I have heard he was interested in Christian Science, a religion which does not believe in medicine. When asked about this, Slim answered with a sideways twist of his head and his chin, "Yeah, I'm a good Christian Scientist until I get a bellyache." He once told his good friend Bobby Rowan of National Airlines, "Hell, I don't need to go to church. All I have to do is open the window." His home was next door to a large church. Actually, I don't believe anyone really knew too much about Slim's innermost religious feelings. When asked about it, he would say, "Well, I don't know yet. I'm still shopping around for a religion that fits me." I'll wager one thing. When Slim arrived at the pearly gate and struck up the conversation with St. Pete, I'll bet he had him laughing before he walked through the gate and sauntered on down those streets of gold. Slim first saw the light of day on August 25th, 1910, in Denver, Colorado. It was not as big a place as it is today, but he found plenty of things that interested him as he grew up there. He was one of three children, one brother, who grew to manhood but died while young, and one older sister who still lives in Denver today. He graduated from high school there, during which time he had taken up a great love for motorcycles. It was natural he'd find a way to own one, a good old American Harley Davidson. During his high school years, he worked for Western Union, delivering telegrams on his motorcycle. Having mechanical talent and not much money, he did his own repair work on his motorcycle, which led to a personal tragedy and became a kind of trademark, if you will, of Slim. While working on the motorcycle, he caught his right hand index finger in the drive chain. In less than a second, half of the finger was destroyed. It never bothered him or dampened his ambition. In later years, he joked about it, sometimes putting it in his nose to give the impression he had about 2 inches of finger up his nose. Always anything for a laugh with Slim. While growing up, he developed the friendship of Captain Charlie France, operations manager of Western Air Express, a fledgling airline at Stapleton Airport right there in Denver. This friendship stimulated Slim's interest in flying. Another friend, Colonel Reeves, taught him to fly. Slim soloed when he was 18 years old in 1928. It began a long career in aviation. Depression days followed. Progress was slow, but Slim was innovative. He started his own business, aeronautical mapping, which he did a few years mapping several states. He also had a neon sign on the bottom of his airplane, which he displayed at night above Denver and Park Hill. This led to confrontation with some of the citizens who nicknamed him Coffee Babbitt. His night flying kept him from getting their night sleep, it seems. Slim reassured them, explaining he never flew lower than 2,000 feet. It didn't help much. All of the pilots around Stapleton Airport had a competitive game they played, which they called the Pants Race. It consisted of a flight over a specified pattern, then return to the field, land, and take off their pants, leaving them on the field, taking off again and flying the same specified pattern, returning again and putting their pants back on. The winner, of course, was the one who did it the fastest, and Slim always won. The other pilot said Slim always won because he was so thin he could take his pants off and put them on quickly. However, many of the other pilots coming back to the field had difficulty locating their pants on the field. If Slim could make a wisecrack, he always did it. In later years, Jerry Wood, who had become a very close friend of his after years of ALPA, the Airline Pilots Association, worked together, he asked him one day, "Slim, why did you ever leave Denver?" Without hesitation, the answer was, "Hell, those damned airplanes had to come in so high over the Rockies for their landings. I couldn't read the numbers on their wings to build up time in my logbook." He did, however, build his time a little in 1935, doing some special flying. It was a political year when the GOP presidential aspirants jockeying for a position to be in the nominee of their party. Slim flew one of them around his His name was Wendell Willkie, an Indiana corporation president. He didn't make it in 1936, but he became the GOP nominee in 1940, losing to Roosevelt, who was running for an unprecedented third term. Eventually, Charlie France put Slim to work as a pilot for Western Air Express. Wherever he worked a little more than a year, Captain France left Western Air Express to assume the duties of operations manager of Eastern Air Transport. And not long after doing so, he persuaded Slim to follow him to EAT. Although he wasn't able to put him on as a pilot initially, Slim joined Eastern in May of 1935 as a mechanic and was signed to the instrument shop in Miami. He didn't stay there long. His seniority date as a pilot was January 20th, 1936. Putting me in that instrument shop, hell, Slim said later, they tried to make a jeweler out of me with those big old hands I've got. Carl Gables was Slim's choice for a place to live in the Miami area. He was a charter member of the Carl Gables Country Club. Meanwhile, George Rohrig, an Eastern executive, had hired a new secretary by the name of Margaret DeGunther. It was only about 2 weeks later that she caught Slim's eye one evening at the country club. He wooed and won Margaret's heart, and they were married a year later. George Rohrig lost his secretary. Margaret and Slim bounced around quite a bit during Slim's first three or so years with Eastern. First the instrument shop, then co-pilot in Miami. Upon promotion to captain, he was sent to New York to fly the Washington merry-go-round, forerunner of today's EAL shuttle. He and Margaret returned to Miami in 1941, settled in Carl Gables, bought a home where he spent the rest of his life. Margaret still lives there. For his first day in EAL's cockpits, it was apparent Slim was destined to be a spirited leader among the pilots. There was some labor unrest among the mechanics, and he gravitated towards settlement of these kind of problems. Almost once he became a tower of strength for the pilots as he sought to secure their first contract. Jerry Wood, who flew as co-pilot with Slim during his first year in 1940, has this to say. I was a new co-pilot. I lucked into one of the extra sections to Miami with Slim. In that eight-hour flight, we became fast friends. We remained so throughout the years, even when we occasionally disagreed. I've never met anyone with a sharper mind or quicker wit. In a stand-up dispute, he invariably came out well ahead. Along with his quick wit and great sense of humor, he could also be incisive when needed, always landing squarely on his own two feet while leaving his opponents where they fell. He was a master strategist, and he spearheaded, with the help of others, our first EAL pilot contract on July 23, 1941. Later in 1947, when Slim, Jerry Woods, Vern Peterson, and others were trying to get gross weight pay into the contract, they were having trouble with Alpha President Dave Beneke, who had his own ideas. At Al Peterson's suggestion, Slim and Jerry took Beneke to lunch, plotting to work him over to their views, but it did no good. Then Jerry relates, Slim delivered his best shot. Dave, it boils down to whether you are working for us or whether we are working for you. That did it. Beneke capitulated. As usual, Slim had won again. Then in 1948, the National Pilot Strike. Slim, Bobby Rowan, and Charlie Ruby provided the main leadership in this battle, and Jerry Wood says they were a great team. G.T. Baker, George Baker, was stubborn as a mule. The airline was shut down until he reopened it with scab pilots. The battle line was drawn, and it looked like Baker was winning. Then by direct pressure from Slim, Jerry Wood, Tony O'Donnell, and insistence of some of Washington politicians with whom they had contact, the CAB threatened to dismember National Airlines and file docket number 3500. This document for dismemberment for being in violation of the Railway Labor Act. This put Baker in the position where he had to settle the strike or lose his airline. Reluctantly, he began to give the posture of doing so. But he pulled every trick in the book, attempting to stick it in and break it off in each striking pilot. It was a sour situation, which dragged along a long time. Then moral rearmament, a sincere, good, do-good philosophy came along, and Baker needed by now to save face, so he embraced the moral rearmament as his personal religion. Meanwhile, Slim, Jerry, and others were indoctrinated with the same philosophy. How well it took in Slim is questionable. Baker was talking to him later and asking if he would like to settle the dispute in question. Slim said, "Hell, I don't care if we settle it in church or in a bar, just as long as we get the damn thing through." The 1930s were the formative years for ALPA. Those early years gave birth to ALPA's magazine, The Airline Pilot. Beneke, working to build up the fledgling publication, knew of Slim's great wit. He was constantly calling Slim in to send in some writings for the magazine, and a few of Slim's contributions follow. I don't know how old ALPA is, perhaps a year older than Freddie Kahn's uniform, but we just got word down here in Miami that this council was surprised to have a new correspondent. So at the last meeting, all my enemies were there, and they put the hat on for the jobs of getting the news back to the States. It's awfully hard to get anything out of Florida, including the DC-3s, climb like the elevator at Hyde Park Hotel. Just the other day, the maintenance department reported 5 coconuts in the right nacelle. Also, we made several Swanee Taylor takeoffs out of Washington. My laundry man will back me up on this. The big news from the Silver Fleet this month is the photobiography contest for the passengers. All of them are presented by the steward with a 4x6 autographed photo of the captain and his wheel holder. And I'd like to remind you, by the way, if it wasn't on the SPAD, it isn't on Eastern's airplanes. That was because of Captain Eddie Rickenbacker. The passengers having the most of these folders by December 1st received a round-trip ticket to Miami from anywhere on the line and a week at the Miami Biltmore, all expenses paid. I just received a telegram from Boris Karloff, of Hollywood, you know, the man who played Frankenstein, stating some passenger had returned to Hollywood with photographs of Captain R.K. Smith and his number one boy, Nellie Gaunt. Now, Boris seemed very worried about future contracts with these photos floating around. Why don't you wire him and tell him you have a job? I know it will relieve his mind. By the way, I wish to correct a statement made about Freddie Kahn's uniform. Freddie says ALPA isn't any older than his uniform. By the way, how did you like Dick Merrill and Jack Lambie's motion picture? I felt the same way. It's a shame Jack couldn't have gone to England during the premiere showings like Dick did. This picture brought to mind a statement made while we were doing aerial mapping by my cameraman. He said, "These cameras ain't no magic box. They only take what they see." But the boys don't need to feel so bad. I once made a name for myself in Hollywood, printed here. It seems I overshot in a recent column and offended some of our readers. I'm really very sorry to hear this, and in the future I'll do as the lighter-than-air pilots say, use the utmost caution in valving the gas. Dr. Merrill was the first to bring these complaints to my attention. To quote Doc Wright, he said, "Babbitt, you're as popular as a skunk at a lawn party with all the natives in Coral Gables." I told him this criticism was unjust and asked him point blank if he had ever heard anything against my character. Doc said, "I've never even heard it mentioned, just because at a recent masquerade ball, I went disguised as a gentleman and nobody recognized me. There's no reason why I should be listed as non-gentlemanly. I'll have you understand, I have never kicked a lady with my hat on." Well, as a monkey said when he spit off the tower, a little of this goes a long way. Stories about his humor around abound. At a party, he happened to be under a table for some good reason, but he stayed there. Finally, someone told him he could come out from under, and Slim said, "Go away. It's shady down here." Anytime Slim didn't want to make an address at an ALPA function, he would say, "I can't. I didn't bring my glasses." Later, Jerry Wood whispered to him, "USOB, you don't even wear glasses." Slim grinned like the cat in that ate the canary. In DC-3 days, he was on a flight, a little uncertain exactly where he was. And about that time, the company radio operator called saying, "ATC wants to know where you are." Slim picked up the mic and said, "Tell them I'm working a problem." And in a minute or two, the radio operator came back again with, "ATC would like to know your position." Slim picked up the mic again saying, "Tell him that's the problem." Sid Shannon once mentioned the master chairman, calling his name Slim, replied, "Oh, hell, he's not the master chairman." "Oh, I thought he was," Shannon replied. Slim said, "Hell, he's like a guy on a bulldozer with the throttle stuck open and one track locked." Slim wisecracked mostly in male company with humor not meant for mixed audiences. One mild example is when he was describing a very nervous guy. That guy was as nervous as a you-know-what in church. About trying to get the company to sign in the contract, Slim's talent was a master, strategist showed. "Let's get the harness on them first. Then later we can come back and tighten up the straps," he said. Through the years, Jerry Wood would chide Slim about being like the famous Greek philosopher Socrates. "Slim," he would say, "all Socrates wanted to do was go down to the corner and wisecrack with the guys. But he never did write anything down. I think Plato followed him around and wrote down what he said, then took credit for the wisdom. Don't you see any similarity?" Jerry really wanted him to write down his humor-coded wisdoms. Slim apparently didn't take the idea too seriously. One evening, he and Bobby Rowan went to Jerry's house but couldn't find him. Slim wisecracked to Bobby, "Oh, he's probably upstairs reading Plato or Pluto." Near the end of his career, Slim was hijacked to Cuba in a Boeing 720. Jerry Wood was Miami chief pilot at the time, and telling about the experience later, Slim feigned profound disappointment. "After that hijacker parted my hair with a pistol shot, then I got back to Miami All that damn Jerry Wood did was give me a bunch of green stamps. Following retirement from ALPA, Slim flew his trips regularly. On his days off, he devoted more time to his family, which he felt he had neglected. He also invested in real estate, which he was very astute. During these same years, he became a scoutmaster, giving many days and nights to the boys in his troop. Slim said he never met a kid he didn't like. The feeling was mutual. They all liked Slim. He had an old, dilapidated bus, which he used to take his scouts to the Keys, camping and swimming, etc. He felt he devoted too much time to ALPA and wanted to make up for that. He was so successful in real estate, I jokingly called him a real estate tycoon. Slim and Margaret had two children, a daughter, the oldest, Barbara Lee, who resides in Houston, Texas, and Randy, who became a pilot with Eastern, following in his dad's footsteps doing ALPA work. Randy is presently on leave from EAL, working as executive administrator to the president of ALPA, Captain Hank Duffy. In his post-ALPA years, Slim really enjoyed being a family man, but he was always ready to help an Eastern pilot or any ALPA member who was in trouble. In 1971, Slim wanted to seek public office in the city he loved, Coral Gables. He ran for city commissioner. His promotional picture had written up on the back, "Coral Gables needs W.T. Slim Babbitt." Resident, 36 years, retired airline pilot, 35 years with Eastern Airlines. No special or vested interest, time to research and carefully evaluate public works and zoning projects. Vote for W.T. Slim Babbitt. Bobby Rowan, his close friend, says his campaign manager, "We didn't have much money during the campaign. Slim decided to have a parade down Miracle Mile, a two-man parade. Bobby was driving the Jeep, and Slim, the passenger, was in the back seat, sitting beside a big stuffed rabbit, nearly as large as Slim himself. On the side of the Jeep was a large sign which read, 'A vote for the rabbit is a vote for Babbitt.' In the election, there were six candidates. Slim came in fifth. His comment was, 'Well, I could have come in sixth, you know.'" Eastern pilots continued to admire Slim Babbitt. Jerry Brown said of Slim, "His consideration of those of us who sat in that right seat alongside of him brought a very special respect and affection for him. He always treated us as an equal and an important part of the team. Not only was Slim a great person to fly with, he earned the respect of his peers through his unending efforts to improve and stabilize our profession." In the middle 1960s, Slim began to have trouble with his eyes, eventually forcing him medical retirement. But with the accumulated sick leave, he was not actually retired until 1970. He had always told Bobby Rowan, his close friend, "Heck, I'd like to hang on until I can be number one on the seniority list." Not many Eastern pilots have that privilege, but Slim was one of them. He continued to show interest in pilot activities as a member of the QBs, the OX5 Aviation Club, and the Retired Eastern Pilots Association, REPA. About 1976, he developed stomach trouble, which proved to be malignant. He was very calm about it all, making trips to the Mayo Clinic, where accurate diagnosis was made. After an operation, he seemed to rally for a while, though he slowly weakened. He went also to MD Anderson Medical Facilities in Houston, but he felt the Mayo Clinic had helped him the most. He became weaker, and in August, and Margaret was with him every hour of every day. On September 19, 1986, the day had come for Slim to make his final flight. West. Margaret was with him every minute. Occasionally, he spoke to her. "Are you ready?" he would ask. "What am I going to get ready for, Slim?" "Well," he said, "we have to go someplace today." She said, "We do?" He answered, "Well, I do." What happened next can only be described as beautiful. A little later, he turned to her again, and he said, "Are you ready now?" Margaret replied quietly, "Yes." With that, Slim raised his arm up high and started turning his hand, moving some control knobs above the windshield in the cockpit. While doing this, he said, "Gosh, these engines are noisy." He then brought his arms back down to his side and made his final takeoff into the sunset. His last moment, Slim was doing what he loved best. He was flying his airplane. That's the story for this Thursday, November 3rd. And we're glad to have read that. We hope you enjoyed it. We had many folks like Slim Babbitt. His son, Randy, eventually became the head of the Airline Pilots Association and then moved up to the chief administrator with the FAA. I'll get that right in a minute. But Randy became head of the FAA in Washington, D.C. So that's our story for today, and we hope you enjoyed. We hope you enjoy these Eastern stories, and we pull them from the Eastern Files. And again, if you would like to contribute a story of your own about your Eastern days in your own voice, or to be read on the broadcast, please give us an email, and we will show you how simple it is to tell your story from the Eastern Files. You can just send them to host@ealradioshow.com. We want you to be a part of the radio show. Until next week and another broadcast from the Eastern Files, we say, Eastern family, we love you. We love you, Eastern.
All my bags are packed, I'm ready to go. I'm standing here outside your door. I hate to wake you up to say goodbye, but the dawn is breaking, it's early morn. The taxi's waiting, he's blown his horn. Already I'm so lonesome I could die. So kiss me and smile for me, tell me that you'll wait for me, hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane, don't know when I'll be back again. Oh babe, I hate to go. There's so many times I've let you down, so many times I've played around. I tell you now, they don't mean a thing. Every place I go, I'll think of you. Every song I sing, I'll sing for you. When I come back, I'll bring your wedding ring. So kiss me and smile for me, tell me that you'll wait for me, hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane, don't know when I'll be back again. Oh babe, I hate to go. The time.
time has come to leave you. One more time, let me kiss you. Then close your eyes and I'll be on my way. Dream about the days to come when I won't have to leave alone. About the times I won't have to say. Kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again. Oh babe, I hate to go. I hate to go.